Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. My name is John Hodge. I'm joined, as always, by J.C. Abbott, the Jumbo Cheese, Mr. Velveeta himself.
Don't tell them about Velveeta, Hodge.
Like any good nickname, it should evolve over time. So I think that the natural progression from Jumbo Cheese to Cheese is Velveeta. What's wrong with Velveeta?
You know what? It's not the worst nickname ever, and someone very kindly told me that now that I'm Velveeta, I'm the first slice in the pack.
Ah, that's awesome.
I know. Wasn't that sweet?
I will say, I don't think I've had like one of the Kraft singles, like, you know, like not even just like the processed cheese, but like the ultra processed cheese since I was a kid. I do still like that cheese on a burger. Like, because it melts so beautifully. There's like an emulsification process that happens with like the 17,000 different chemicals that are in that cheese and make it what it is, which, let's be honest, is not actually cheese at all. I'm not sure what it is. But to eat it on its own, no, I wouldn't do that. I like real cheese now that I'm a grown up.
It's the ultimate grilled cheese, Hodge. My mother makes a fantastic grilled cheese with the Kraft singles. They are delightfully greasy because she butters just every side of the bread. And if it's a cold winter's afternoon, have a bunch of grilled cheese sandwiches like that with some soup. That's prime to me.
A cold winter's afternoon in British Columbia. Yeah, it's +8 and raining outside. Yeah, it's a cold winter afternoon out in British Columbia. But I will not disrespect Mrs. Velveeta. Those sandwiches do sound lovely. I would probably just supplement it, like put in a Kraft single, but then put in some like sharp cheddar or some smoked Gouda or even maybe some goat cheese, like something else to supplement it. But I mean, I haven't had just a classic
goat cheese. Goat cheese.
Goat cheese goes like fire in a grilled cheese sandwich.
Hey, I love goat cheese. I've never tried it in a
grilled cheese sandwich. Has to be a supplemental cheese. So it's not the main cheese. Like, you put in slices of cheese, but then on one of the slices of bread on the inside, you put in a little bit of goat cheese and it melts down. It is so good. I wouldn't just have a goat cheese. I wouldn't do. But as a supplemental cheese in a grilled cheese, I'm all in there. Though, now that I'm speaking about this out loud, should you be eating cheese? That feels like cannibalism.
Hey, I love cheese, man. All sorts of different cheese. I like Super Bowl or Grey Cup. If I'm not at the game, if I'm watching on TV, any big sporting event, national championship, whatever it may be, I get the whole spread of the fanciest cheeses I can possibly buy at my local deli and just house that stuff over the course of the game. I love stanky, weird cheese.
I like fancy cheeses. That's my wife's like Christmas tradition that she grew up with, was they would have fancy cheese on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. And we have adopted that, and I really enjoy it. But I do not like the stinky stuff.
You're missing out.
No, I'm not. I am missing out on nothing but bacteria and grossness. I like the sharp
stinky
stuff.
The like stinkier the cheese, stuff, the sweeter. The stinky,
no.
It's sweet. No. It's delightful. No, it's...
No.
Don't be a toddler. You gotta eat your blue cheese.
Okay, you can't be like, I like eating Kraft singles, and then a moment later be like, don't be a toddler.
Only on grilled cheese. It's the only acceptable use of it.
And a burger. It's good on a burger.
Yeah.
You can't hit a Kraft single on a cheeseburger.
Anything where it's required exclusively to melt.
Yes, because that is the reason for ultra-processing cheese, right, is to optimize the meltification of the cheese, which is a word I think I just coined, by the way. I don't think that's in the dictionary, but that's fine. Enough cheese talk. Today, we're discussing how Hamilton's depth chart is shaping up for 2025.
Craig Reynolds being on the job for 10 years as the president of the Rough Riders.
11 players moving on from the CFL's Invitational Combine.
Canadian receiver Elik Iomara running an impressive 40-yard dash at the NFL Combine.
AJ Ouellette showing off a newly shredded physique.
And Canadian receiver Richie Sindani stepping away from football. But first, Hodge, you reported the financial details for Ottawa's free agent additions. Can you tell us how much each addition made and how strong you think their depth chart is on paper?
Yeah, we'll run through the signings really quickly. As previously reported by Three Down Nation, Eugene Lewis, $223,000 in hard money. He got a $100,000 signing bonus as part of that contract. And I mention that because if, let's say, Eugene Lewis gets hurt, not that he's a injury-prone player, but if he gets hurt, I don't want to hear people on Twitter being like, now the Red Blacks can go out and sign a bunch of players because they have all this money. No, he got $100,000 up front. Everything else is, yeah, like it would save a little bit of money if he were to end up on the sixth game for most of the year, but not a lot. That $100,000 is gone. He's only left to be paid $113,000, or pardon me, $123,000 the rest of the year. Most of that money has been spent in his pocket already. Peter Godbert got $145,000 in hard money. Bit of a pay cut from what he made with the Riders the last couple of years, but still a good salary for a starting CFL center. I think that that dollar figure means there will not be a competition between him and Eric Starzala. He will be the starter in the middle of that offensive line. Matthew Schiltz, $112,000 to be the backup to Drew Brown, presumably filling the role that Jeremiah Masoli had a year ago. William Stanback, $106,000 in hard money. I think he's an upgrade there. And then their defensive backs, whether it's Amari Henderson, Robert Priester, Nafis Lyon, Tunde Adeleke, they are all under $100,000 in hard money. So they went bargain bin shopping for sure to fill out that back end. And let's get into that depth chart, by the way. Offensively, this team is pretty sensational. I'm not going to lie. Eugene Lewis and Khalil Pimpleton to the boundary. That might be the best combination of receivers that any team in the CFL has to the boundary right now, assuming, of course, that that is, in fact, how the depth chart shapes up. And if you are listening to this or watching this on YouTube, feel free to bring up my article, by the way, on the Red Blacks. You can see everything that we're talking about here with the depth chart. Braylon Addison, Justin Hardy, obviously coming off an all-CFL season. The offensive line is unchanged, with the exception of Godbert. Their depth, I think, is really good with guys like Jacob Ruby, Starzala, Dante Bull. Huge year for him, going into a contract year, former first overall CFL draft pick. Defensively is where things get a little bit more interesting. The defensive line, which was very good a year ago, is back in its entirety. The linebacking core, I really like the depth. You've got guys like Frankie Griffin and Javon Santos-Knox, who have lots of starting experience, but this is also a team that between Davion Taylor, who made 9 starts last year, Ace Ely, who came over from the BC Lions, they've got depth. Adarius Pickett's supposed to be healthy. Secondary, however, the backfield of this defense is where things get interesting. I like Nafis Lyon. I like Robert Priester. Elijah McGee, I thought, played pretty good for this team last year. You know, Lamont is okay. He had a really rough rookie year, I thought, in 2023. I thought last year DeAndre Lamont played better. Amari Henderson really struggled at times in Saskatchewan. So I don't know how this secondary is going to look. Obviously, William Fields, the club's new defensive coordinator, is a defensive back guy. And he also coached a couple of these guys last year in Toronto. If you want to talk about Tunde Adeleke, who they added, Robert Priester. But that, I think, is the only spot I have serious questions about in Ottawa. Overall, I think this offense is better than it was a year ago. I think this defense is better than it was a year ago. And I think that the Red Blacks are looking like a 10-plus win team on paper.
I absolutely agree with that assessment. I think this is a dramatically improved Red Blacks team marching in the right direction. And if you're able to find early MOP odds, I'm on the record as thinking that the MOP could come from this Red Blacks offense. In particular, a guy like Khalil Pimpleton. Now that you have Eugene Lewis in that offense and Justin Hardy in that offense that are going to command attention underneath, it's going to be so tough for defenses to prevent Pimpleton from going over the top on them. It really reminds me of what Tommy Condell's offense looked like back with the Hamilton Tiger Cats when a guy named Brandon Banks went off for all those yards and made himself an MOP in the CFL. I think Khalil Pimpleton could have that type of season if he stays healthy based on the makeup of this offense. I'm really, really high on it. As for the defense, I like the fact that they have options, right? A lot of people might say that that is a weak point in the secondary. I don't necessarily know that they're wrong on that, but they have the flexibility to go with a number of different guys depending on who's better coming out of training camp, who's performing at that moment, and who takes the next step in their career, right? Nafis Lyon, I think, is a great addition. I'm not sold on Amari Henderson, but maybe it's CJ Colden who takes that next step. Or maybe it's a guy like Elijah McGee, who they've wanted to start in the past, who can take that next step and go play corner. Maybe Adrian Fry or Bennett Williams in year two can take that step in addition to the veterans that they brought in. I think that's a really smart way to go about constructing your rosters, to say, hey, look, we don't know who's going to start. We know we have to improve. Let's give ourselves three or four different options or three or four different potential combinations in our secondary that we can go with depending on how things shake out and what is going to be best for us at that current moment. I think that virtually guarantees that they'll at least be slightly better than they were at the end of last year when they really struggled when Pickett wasn't on the field.
Interestingly, the only defensive back addition who got a signing bonus, in other words, who has guaranteed money in their deal, was Amari Henderson. $5,000 signing bonus. Ask Rider fans about Amari Henderson. I don't think you could find someone who is more maligned other than maybe like Tino Sinceri, who 10 years later is still catching strays from Ryderville. That being said, he does have length, right? That is very rare for CFL defensive backs. Amari Henderson, 6'3", I think it is, but like long arms. That obviously makes life easy for a defensive back. You do not have to be as fast as other guys. When you have 6 or 7 extra inches of height and reach, so we'll see. That is also a position, and you mentioned guys like Colden or guys like Fields, JC, of course. That is a position, right, where generally speaking, teams should be able to find somebody, right? We have rookie defensive backs who come into the CFL every year and do good things. Special teams-wise, Lewis Ward, obviously as consistent as anybody. Richie Leone, a little bit of a down year last year, but he's still a good punter in this league. And then Devontae Dedmon, Tobias Harris, both proven returners. And then you throw in Khalil Pimpleton, who might even get sprinkled into that returning role. And you have to love what this team has on special teams. Bob Dice, the club's head coach, has a background in special teams. And in my opinion, that is highly evident in that part of the roster. I also like some of the depth Canadians this team has, whether it's Lucas Cormier, James Peter, guys who I think should be primed for really, really nice things that they can do on special teams. Aiden John can probably be considered in that group, though Aiden John, arguably former, I believe it's third round pick out of St. Mary's, could be primed to do more actual pass rushing this year. I thought that he did a nice job of that in spot duty in 2024, his second year in the league. So I really like this Red Blacks team on paper. Obviously, it is still the offseason. It is on paper. We never know what this team will look like in practice. But I think that the Ottawa Red Blacks will be a double-digit win team in 2025. They fell just short of that at 9-8-1 in 2024. Obviously, we're outclassed in the postseason, losing the East semifinal to the Argonauts. I like what they have here. The article won't be out until Thursday morning, JC, but I've taken the liberty of reporting the financials for Hamilton's free agent signings as well. Star receiver Kenny Lawler got almost $290,000 in hard money to come over from Winnipeg, while All-West Division offensive lineman Liam Dobson got $210,000 in hard money, and strong side linebacker Reggie Stubblefield will earn almost $150,000 in hard money in 2025. Taking a look at the depth chart I've made, what are the strengths and weaknesses of this roster in Steeltown?
Well, the strength right away is offensively in the receiving core. I think the addition of Kenny Lawler makes this a really intriguing unit, as we've talked about before, with Tim White and Shamar Bridges and Keandre Smith and even Drew Walutarski coming over from the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. All of those guys are proven options. I think that makes for an exciting receiving core with Greg Bell in the backfield, who we know can also go down the seam if necessary. I think Bo Levi Mitchell has an abundance of weapons and a still proven offensive line in front of him that swaps out one starter for Liam Dobson coming in at right guard and Coulter Woodmansey moving over to center. But I still will think will be a top-tier unit in this league. The defense is where I see the issues, and I think the secondary will be improved with Deshaun Amos. But linebacker, I have some question marks right now. You have Ryan Baker penciled in at middle linebacker. I don't think ultimately he will be the guy who starts there. They need to find another Canadian starter somewhere in order to replace that, but I think they'd like to get better at linebacker. And then along the defensive line, they've plugged some of those gaps. Julian Hauser comes over, Taiwan Garbutt as the two defensive ends, but I still think they're lacking depth at that position. And that is an area where I can see through this draft process, because it is such a deep defensive line draft, Hodge, that they could add a few pieces, and you might see potentially, depending on how things shake out, maybe a rookie Canadian starter along that defensive line, with guys like Reese Martin, Owen Hubert, and Luke Brubacker taking the next step as backups and rotational players there. I think that might be where this team is heading. But as for right now, I think they have some real question marks in that front seven.
I think you're bang on, JC. I thought that this offensive line, I mean, let's not forget Ed Hervey, as the club's general manager last year, used a first-round pick on Nathaniel Desmoulins-Duguay out of Laval, who I thought was the best offensive lineman at the CFL Combine. Tested really well out of Rimouski. He played center there at Laval, played mostly tackle, but like I thought maybe he could be the next center, right? David Beard leaves, you slot in Desmoulins-Duguay there, and you get a lot cheaper, right? Obviously, David Beard was making $200,000 last year. Desmoulins-Duguay is going into year two of his rookie deal. That could have been a big savings. No, the Tiger Cats are like, we had arguably the best offensive line in the CFL in 2024. We want to keep that going, and we're happy to spend the money, which is why they brought in Liam Dobson. I know some Bomber fans were concerned about Liam Dobson's decision to leave. Well, it's hard to argue when the Tiger Cats offered $210,000 in hard money. I was led to believe that the Winnipeg Blue Bombers offered close to that amount, but the Tiger Cats did offer more. And I think that that is a good personal fit for Liam Dobson, a guy who previously played at Maine and has roots closer to Hamilton than he does in Winnipeg. As for the receiving core, it is sensational. I think if you're talking about early MOP odds, Bo Levi Mitchell could be a good buy. He almost won it last year. This receiving core is better than last year's was. And I think year two of him working together there with that coaching staff and with everybody else, I think could bode really well. Yes, this is year three for him, but he missed so much of 2023. I think that 2024, in a way, was like really the first year that Bo got fully ingratiated into that system. So I like what the Tiger Cats have built here offensively. This team is going to score a lot of points. Defensively, the secondary, I mean, you have to love Stavros Katsantonis at safety. Deshaun Amos, a great add. But I do have some questions about some of these spots. Reggie Stubblefield has only started, I believe it's 13 career CFL games. He's coming in off an ACL. That's a lot of money to pay to him at strong side linebacker. As much as he has been a difference maker, I don't think you can just set your watch to the fact that he's going to be the Reggie Stubblefield of 2023. Destin Talbert, I've got penciled in at field side half. I'm not sure he's the answer. We'll have to wait and see. And then in the linebacking core, right, there were some good linebackers available. Brian Cole, I think the Tiger Cats think he could be the best special teams player in the CFL, or he has the potential to be that. I don't think he's a starter. And along the defensive line, I think you make a great point, JC, about the draft. That is a deep position. The Tiger Cats have the second overall pick. They also pick at nine. At least officially, I think they're at 10 right now. They will be at 9 when the BC Lions lose their first round pick for violating the salary cap this past year. And so I think they could use one or even both of those picks to address the D-line. Should be noted that general manager Ted Gavaya did, in Winnipeg, always have a Canadian starter at defensive tackle. So if that is something that he wants to emulate in Hamilton, I think that's a possibility. Miles Fox, I think, is certainly a serviceable nose tackle, but I don't think he's somebody who is a game wrecker in the middle. Casey Sales is, but that nose tackle spot might be a good spot to either rotate a young Canadian or even, as you said, start a young Canadian. It's tough to make the jump as a starter to the CFL as a rookie for a lot of Canadians, but it's not a bad idea given how deep this defensive line draft is. And if you're the Ticats, I mean, yeah, if you want to go D-line at 2 and get you know, your favorite one, you can. But you're also going to be able to still draft a really good D-lineman, even in round 3, right, depending on how many get picked through. So I think that the Tabbies did a good job of attacking the spots in free agency where there was maybe going to be limited talent available in the draft and leaving the spots where there were more options in the draft a little more open, right, for what they can get there.
Yes, absolutely. And I think to add to this discussion in terms of, well, do they start a rookie Canadian there? If fans are saying, well, we've got Miles Fox, like, why would you pay him that money to not start him? Ted Gavaya has been very open about the fact that the guys he's brought over are as much related to culture and building a winning attitude as they are actual impact on the field. And he has said point blank that not all of these guys will start. To me, Miles Fox is a natural fit to be your backup rotational guy. He can start if Casey Sales goes down. He's not a bad player to have on the roster for depth. I don't necessarily think that you want to go into the season with him starting a defensive tackle and Ryan Baker starting at linebacker. That's probably not a comfortable situation to be in. There are things you can do in this draft more than any other draft to address those issues.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Craig Reynolds has officially been on the job as the president and CEO of the Saskatchewan Roughriders for 10 years, celebrating the anniversary this past week. What grade would you give his performance in his current role?
I thought a lot about this, and I'm not going to beat around the bush. I would give him a C. It's a passing grade, but it's not a good grade. And the reason for that is, first off, this team has not been to a Grey Cup since 2013. Appearing and winning Grey Cups is the way that you measure teams generally, right? At least for on-field success. They do have a first-place West Division finish in there, and they do have a winning record since Craig Reynolds took over. It's 70-67-1. Kudos to Joel Gasson, our contributor at Regina, who wrote a really nice column on this and put that stat together. That being said, attendance is down 11% since Craig Reynolds took over. Should be noted that his first year at the helm, they were awful. Right, they went 0-9 with Corey Chamberlain as the head coach, Brennan Tamman as the GM. Craig Reynolds elected to fire those two individuals at the halfway point of the season, and attendance actually went up in 2016, which is interesting. It trended up until the pandemic hit. Since then, the last three seasons, Saskatchewan has averaged in and around 27,000 fans per game. That is not good enough, and I appreciate that the pandemic is a factor in that. a lot of fans who attend Rider games come from outside of Regina to do so. And so when gas prices are high, when inflation is high, that does negatively affect, obviously, the situation there. I also will say the 2022 Grey Cup, I still have a sour taste in my mouth about that for a couple reasons. One was the debacle that was the halftime show. And the other was the fact that the stadium was empty. And I appreciate that Rider fans weren't very excited about the matchup of Andrew Harris versus Winnipeg. That's probably the worst nightmare that Rider Nation had heading into that 2022 season. But that Grey Cup, I've now covered three in person. I thought that the Vancouver Grey Cup blew everything else out of the water, and the Hamilton Grey Cup was better than the Regina Grey Cup. Obviously, that is just my personal opinion. I'll let you address that, JC, if you want to as well. I know that those are the three Grey Cups that you've covered in person on a full-time basis. There are things to like about Craig Reynolds' time as the president and CEO in Saskatchewan, and I think that there are some struggles for which he is not to blame. But all in all, I don't think that you can argue that this is better than a C. Zero Grey Cup wins, zero Grey Cup appearances, attendance is down, and the team is basically 500 under his watch. That is not a scintillating resume.
Yeah, I agree with your Grey Cup rankings of the last three there, Hodge. I think you've got them in the correct order. There was just something lacking when it was in Regina. I think partly because of the matchup and the lack of attendance because of fans that bought tickets hoping that their team would be there or they would have something that they wanted to see and then opted not to show up. That was the major factor there, less so than the planning and execution, but it was disappointing nonetheless. As for Craig Reynolds, I'm going to be a little bit kinder than you were. I'm going to give him a B. And my logic for this is, yes, the Riders have not necessarily had, you know, consistent success on the field. I think a president plays a role in that to a certain extent. I don't think you can necessarily blame Craig Reynolds for that. And I think at times he has made moves to change it up when he's needed to. And they have sparked better seasons at certain points, right? It's been a bit of a roller coaster. But I don't necessarily blame him for their lack of success on the field. What I will say is the attendance being down, even though there are external factors, that's on him. And I think the Riders' perception in the marketplace, just nationally and in the context of the CFL, has fallen slightly, right? This was the marquee model franchise when Craig Reynolds took over. Jim Hopson made it that. Everyone looked at the Riders as this shining example of success. And yes, we still acknowledge that they are a rabid fan base and Rider Nation is literally everywhere in the world. You cannot escape them. But the Bombers have overtaken them. They've been replaced by their biggest rival as the most successful franchise in the CFL, both on and off the field. And I don't think that gap is closing anytime soon. In fact, I think it may be widening at this stage. I don't necessarily think he's made the community connections needed to compensate for some of those global events that have drawn fans away from the stadium and prevented them from getting into the building. I think there's been a lot of apathy with the way the Riders have handled themselves. That falls directly on the president and the CEO, on a guy who is supposed to be a business mind. That's the reason he was hired. I think there's a lot left to be desired from the way the Riders have operated over the last number of years. And so because of that, no, they're not in the toilet. But you cannot give him a fantastic grade while they've had average results while playing essentially with house money to start.
I think you're being too kind. Yes, attendance has been, or pre-pandemic was good. Let's not forget, this team opened a brand new stadium in 2016. So that obviously, though the team was terrible in 2016, as Chris Jones burned the thing to the ground, right? To build from, for like to use a farming analogy, he basically burnt the crop in 2016 to build something that would be good. It eventually got decent. 2017, they were okay. 2018, they were the James Wilder amazing catch away from making it to the Grey Cup through the East Division, which would have been so weird to have a Saskatchewan-Calgary Grey Cup. But whatever. We've had a Winnipeg-Saskatchewan Grey Cup, so theoretically anything's allowed at this point. He did not build the stadium. Jim Hobson, right, who, by the way, piloted the Riders to a Grey Cup championship at home in 2013, was the one who ultimately got the stadium built. And look, financially, the Riders handle the pandemic pretty well. But I've also seen on social media, Rider fans pointing to, hey, when you look at the Rider store, like if a new line of CFL merchandise comes out, this hoodie at the Bomber store or in Hamilton or in BC or whatever is $90 and the Riders are charging $115. And this is obviously anecdotal. I've not done a deep dive on reporting on what CFL teams charge for merchandise, but I do know that there are fans in Saskatchewan who have openly grumbled on social media about the fact that they feel like they're paying a premium for the same merchandise that other teams have available that is less expensive, like to an extent they feel taken advantage of. And in terms of the Grey Cup attendance, one issue I think that exists in Saskatchewan is that in a lot of markets, people consider themselves CFL fans. Do they cheer for the Tiger Cats? Yes. Or the Red Blacks? Or the Elks? Or the Stampeders? Sure. But they are CFL fans in their hearts. In Saskatchewan, it feels like everybody is a Rider fan. And if the Riders aren't in it, they don't care. And that was on full display in 2022. Mm. Now, should it be Craig Reynolds' responsibility to make the entire province of Saskatchewan fall in love not only with the Rough Riders, but the CFL as a whole? No. That would be, I think, a bit of a silly thing to say. But I think if you were to foster a environment where fans were excited for the Grey Cup, regardless of who's in it, we would have seen better attendance. Because the reality was the Tiger Cats were never close to making the Grey Cup in 2023, yet that stadium was full. The BC Lions did not get particularly close to hosting or to making it to the Grey Cup in 2024. That stadium was still full. And the Riders had awful attendance. Like, what percentage of seats would you say were filled? I thought it was about 50% for that Grey Cup in 2022.
50 is probably a little low, but it's no higher than 70.
I would have to look back at my notes, but it was noticeably empty, which I thought was kind of depressing when you look at the fact that the tickets were sold. The tickets sold, right? These are people who would just rather not go. Which is disappointing. The other thing I will say, and I'm not sure if this has ever been officially reported, but there are lots of people who behind the scenes in CFL circles will tell you that the reason that the CFL operations cap exists is because when Chris Jones was hired as the head coach and general manager of the Saskatchewan Roughriders, he spent so much money and hired so many scouts across so many different cities and states and places across the United States and North America, was that Craig Reynolds had the idea of what if we capped the spending for everybody? Now, that has not been confirmed by Craig Reynolds himself or the Saskatchewan Roughriders as a team. And I don't believe that that's ever been officially reported. But I do sometimes see Rider fans bemoan the fact like, well, it's a shame that we have all this money as a team and we're the most profitable, but we can't outspend everybody. And I appreciate why that is a sensitive topic for Rider fans, because especially the old timers remember back in the 70s and the 80s when BC and Toronto and Montreal were winning Grey Cups and championships and doing all these things because they had oodles and oodles of money to spend while the Riders were holding telethons just to keep the lights on. Like, there's a reason why historically for those decades the Riders were not very competitive. The Bombers were in the same boat, certainly during the 1970s, the 1990s, where they just could not compete financially with some of the other clubs. Well, now the shoe's on the other foot. The Riders are the haves. The have-nots for the last, I mean, things have changed in Vancouver the last couple of years, but I'm talking about for the last 20 years, the have-nots have been the Argos, have been the Alouettes, have been the Lions. Well, all of a sudden now, when the Riders have more money to spend than anybody else, now we're capping it. Well, I've been led to believe, again, I'm not saying conclusively, but it is kind of considered an open secret in CFL circles that the riders were the ones who pushed to have the operations cap to corral the spending of the mega maniacal Chris Jones. And so if that hadn't been implemented, first of all, I think the CFL would be in a better place as a whole because we'd have more coaches, more development, all of those things. But also the riders could theoretically flex those financial muscles and say, hey, yeah, screw everybody else. For 30 years, we were the have-nots and we were the ones who had to scrape by. Now that we've got the cash, we're going to flex it and use it to try to put together a winner. And if you can't compete with that, too bad. You can enjoy watching our Grey Cup parade on your television or your phone screen. And that's not what happened.
Yeah, I think it's things like that, the other elements that you mentioned, that leaves Rider fans feeling somewhat neglected or taken advantage of. Like they are, their fandom is a given and not necessarily worked for by the organization, that Craig Reynolds isn't necessarily pushing his advantage or trying to do a level of outreach and make things accessible because he knows that he can have higher prices for things and people will still pay, that he can limit costs around the league and try and make sure that the Riders don't have to spend all that money to utilize that advantage because fans are still going to show up. And, well, some of them have stopped doing so. And I think that is fair, right? I don't think it's a crisis situation by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think it's a bungling of the business, but it's certainly not a strategy that has the club growing like it once was.
The other thing I'll say, and this was something that Joel Gasson mentioned to me while we were talking about the article that he was going to write, is he said a lot of teams, let's keep in mind, as much as the Riders have fallen in the last little bit, a lot of teams would kill for where the Riders are right now. And that is true. The Riders are not in a crisis mode, which is why I'm not giving Craig Reynolds an F or even a D or even a C minus. I'm giving him a C. I just think that there's more here that this team can do. They started in an amazing position. It was always going to be hard to improve upon what the late, great Jim Hobson was able to accomplish. And I was at Labor Day this year. I thought it was awesome. It was an amazing game day experience. The stadium was incredible. The fans were amazing. It's one of the best CFL games I've not just had the privilege of covering, but attending. And I've been attending CFL games since I was 5. It was absolutely fantastic. I just think that that should be every game in Saskatchewan, or at least most games should reach close to that level. And they didn't. Right, Labor Day was over capacity with standing room tickets that they sold. The rest of the year, they averaged a little more than 27. That's not good enough. JC, the CFL Invitational Combine, which, by the way, is not an invitational, was held in Waterloo, after which 11 players were granted invitations to the main combine in Regina later this month. Because as we know, the CFL Combine is an invitational event. Those who advanced were Manitoba quarterback Jackson Tuchinski, McMaster quarterback Keegan Hall, Alberta running back Opie Oshinubi, Davenport receiver Hakeem Harris, Guelph offensive lineman Ethan Pyle, Concordia offensive lineman Felix Despin, Laurier defensive lineman Chisnazem Tizim, Windsor linebacker Liam Hoskins, Montreal linebacker Gabriel Lassard, UBC defensive back Ronan Horrell, and Laurier defensive back Malik Cote-Azare. I'm going to give myself a C-plus on those pronunciations, by the way. Which
that
of those players?
High.
Oh, don't be hating.
Hey, I'm not saying I could do any better, but...
The Laurier defensive lineman, I would say Chisnazem Tizim, but we're going to meet Mr. Tizim. I'll say it that way. At the combine, and I'll be sure to ask him how his name is pronounced. Which of those players stood out to you most?
I think there was some pretty impressive performances across the board, but I'm going to highlight two guys for you, Hodge. First of all, Alberta running back Opie Oshinubi. Oshinubi, we'll find out how his name is pronounced as well as the combine. My apologies to Opie as we, I'm sure, butcher his name in the meantime. This is a guy who ran 4.45 in the 40-yard dash at 223 pounds. That just doesn't happen at any CFL combine, let alone the Invitational. We very rarely have players that size moving that fast. And I'll ask this to you, Hodge. Have you seen Opie with his shirt off?
No.
No. Well, look, this is perhaps a sensitive subject, but go and look it up. Go on the Instagram. Go find Opie with his shirt off, because it's something to behold. I mean, if you want to feel envious about another person, look at how this guy is built, because he would make Greek gods blush. He is an absolute Adonis, chiseled up muscle. I would argue it's akin to what Johnny Augustine looked like coming out through his draft process, where he was just cut up, except he's like double the size of Johnny Augustine. That's what you're looking at with Opie Oshinobi. I think the performance on the field, you can question what he is going forward, because he was the backup behind Matthew Peterson with the Golden Bears. And when Matthew Peterson went down last year, he didn't necessarily seize the opportunity with both hands. But from a physical standpoint, there's a lot to like and a lot that CFL teams will want to shape there. I'm very intrigued to see him live and in person in Regina. And then the second guy that I want to highlight is Davenport receiver Hakeem Harris. This is a guy playing at a Division II school, and I thought about putting him on my watch list for the Invitational Combine, and I decided against it because he simply didn't have the production at that level. Basically, didn't do anything until his senior year, and then had like 12 catches for 230 yards, one touchdown. A lot of that production came on one long catch. He was not a guy who was lighting it up at a low level of competition, but comes in, measures in at 6'2", 210. That's really good size for a CFL receiver, and absolutely blows the workout out of the water. 38.5 in the vert is the big number there, over 10 in the broad. I think he's going to be a really intriguing guy to see in the one-on-ones at the National Combine, and to dig into in terms of why wasn't he more effective at his level of competition? Why wasn't this guy a starter for his entire collegiate career? Because you see the flashes, you see those athletic numbers, and then you're left wondering why there wasn't more dominance, because there are just not many guys at the D2 level who can put up numbers like that at that size. He clearly can, but it didn't translate on the field. I'll be intrigued to see his answers for that as we move through this draft process.
Well, that is kind of the hallmark of this event, right? If you're somebody with high athleticism and great production, you're going to the main combine. You don't have to go to the Invitational, which, as a reminder, is not invitational. It's an open, anybody can go. If you want to pay your way to Toronto, you can go. I don't think it costs anything to register, but you have to cover your own travel to get to this event. You are not comped. Unlike the main combine, which is an invitational, despite the fact that the word invitational is not in its name. I was at Opie Oshinobi's only 100-yard performance at the collegiate level in 2023. Matt Peterson, who was on pace to basically break records with the Golden Bears, got hurt relatively early on in that game. And Oshinobi, in I think it was around three quarters of work, put up 192 yards along the ground. I was going, who the heck is this guy? I went to that game specifically to watch Matt Peterson. Felt disappointed after he got hurt. By the way, Peterson currently on the depth chart with the Hamilton Tiger Cats. And I left feeling not disappointed at all, because I got the chance to watch this guy who looked extremely dynamic. Now, the funny part is that he never had another 100-yard game. Part of that is him sharing the backfield with Matthew Peterson. I also, speaking to some people, there were some concerns maybe about conditioning, but you can't argue, right, with these testing results. 6'1", 223, 25 reps of 225 pounds on the bench, 4.45. There are a lot of NFL legit running backs who are lighter than this, shorter than this, and slower than this, and not as strong as this. Now, the lack of production will hurt Oshinubi. I also don't think he's a guy who CFL teams are going to be like, oh, he's going to be our starter in a year. No, he'll be a guy who is a fullback, a special teams player. A rough comp for him could be Michael Kryczyk, who was a second-round pick to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers last year, as a guy who's cut up, ultra-athletic, but didn't have necessarily a ton of production to go along with it. Two other guys who I will highlight really quickly who fall into a similar category of Oshinubi as not a ton of production, but tested really well, both from the University of Toronto, hardly a bastion for Vanier Cup success, but a couple of really, really good testers who are interesting. Lucas Stoikos, running back, 5'10", 233, 27 reps on the bench, ran a 4.59. That is really good for a player of his size. The other one I will highlight is at 248 pounds, 6'5", Ryan Collins, who played not just linebacker. He played linebacker this past year, but has previously played DB. He ran a 4.88, which is not like stellar, but is very good for his size. And when you talk to people in and around the league, they will sometimes bemoan the lack of this body type that is available in the draft. Kind of that 235 to 250 pound player, because teams want those type of guys on special teams, right? They don't want 185 pound DBs running down on specials. They want guys who are this size but can also run. And there are lots of players who are this weight, they just can't run. There are also lots of players who run the appropriate time. They're just not heavy enough. So I think these two guys at a U of T have an opportunity, not necessarily to hash out great CFL careers as starters, but be guys who, if they're willing to do the dirty work and learn to block and learn to play specials, have all the physical tools to do so. And again, to me, this is a big part of what this event is about. You're not going to find, there have been some stories, don't get me wrong, of guys becoming CFL starters from this event. But by and large, it is an event to flex those testing numbers, even though you might not have a lot of production. Or if you do have lots of productions, show that you're actually a good athlete, right? And show that you can put up those testing numbers. I thought that these two guys from Toronto flexed in the testing for sure.
Yeah, and it's very... It's important to point out that being invited from the Invitational to the National is not necessarily a indication that that player will be drafted, and not being invited is not necessarily an indication that that player will not be drafted. There are lots of guys who don't get the nod up to the main showcase who end up having success or getting drafted by a CFL team because they still proved something and they caught the eye of one particular group. I think if you look at the DB group, obviously Ronan Horrell from UBC gets the nod. He's over 6'1". That's great. Malik Cote-Azar put up fantastic numbers across the board as a smaller DB. He gets elevated because of this. But we talked about Jake Norcharek last week from Manitoba. I don't think he did anything with his testing numbers to dissuade teams from taking a look at him in this draft process. He checked all the boxes across the board as a big DB. And also a guy like Gideon Agay from Calgary tested out really well as a DB who's above 6'1". Those are not very common body types to find in the CFL draft process, and you have to think that teams are going to take a look at those athletic numbers regardless of whether those players actually end up in Regina.
You make a good point about Nitichorik. He had the fourth best three cone of anybody. The three cone, and you'd know this better than I do, JC, but I've spoken to people who say that is a short person's drill because it is essentially a lower center of gravity type drill. And yet at 6'4¼", like this is not the U Sports DB who's listed at 6'4 and then measures in at 6'1½". He was officially measured at 6'4¼". Well, 6'8", 2" in the three cone. That is sensational quickness for somebody of that size. Only 205 pounds, only 6 reps on the bench, not amazing. But 4.74 is legit at the 40-yard dash. So Jake Nitichorik, though he did not get an invitation to the main combine. I agree, JC. He will absolutely be in a training camp, likely as a draft pick, because there's just not that many guys who have that athleticism at that size. Elik Iamonu ran a 4.44 second 40-yard dash at the NFL Combine, where he was the only Canadian who participated in the testing events. Quarterback Curtis Rourke out of Indiana was also in attendance, though he did not participate in testing due to his ongoing ACL recovery. Given how well Iamonu ran at 6'2" and 206 pounds, where will he get picked in the 2025 NFL Draft?
I think I put the over-under money for Iamonu in the second round. I think he doesn't get out of day two, but he's going to be a late second round, early third round pick in this upcoming draft. Really good size. I thought his testing checked all the boxes. He was great in the jumps. The 40 was really good for his frame. I think it got maybe overshadowed a little bit because of the group he was running with this year. This was, of course, the group with the most receivers to run under a 4.4 in NFL history. They were absolutely ridiculous. Normally, if you run a 4.44, you're going to be in the top 10 of finishers in this event for your position. He simply wasn't because the group around him was so fast, but that's no disrespect to the numbers he put up. They are nothing to sneeze at, and I think he is going to rise through this draft process. He's still not a finished product. He's a young player, and I think his 10-yard time was not nearly as impressive as his 40-yard time, which suggests maybe he has a little bit of an issue getting started and getting off the line that teams are going to have to clean up. But let's not forget, this is the kid who put up nearly 300 yards and 3 touchdowns against Travis Hunter, the guy who could very well go first overall in this draft, will certainly not get outside of the top 5, the two-way Heisman Trophy winner. Iamonu is basically the only one who took him to the woodshed during his college career. I think now that you've seen the athleticism, check all the boxes, you're going to be very confident in selecting this young man.
I mean, you know this better than me, but the NFL, like the receiving classes that have come out have been unbelievable, like it seems, more than any other position. This is a position with depth. And so a few years ago, maybe he goes a little bit higher. Like Chase Claypool, for instance, a relatively recent Canadian who went through the process, also blew the doors off the testing at a very similar size, a little bit heavier, a little bit taller. But he ended up going right around the middle of the second round. And even though he had an amazing rookie career or rookie year, his career might be over in the NFL, mm-hmm. right? So it's a very bizarre position to project, right? If you're testing like this, if you're performing like this as an offensive lineman, you're not getting out of round one. Everybody needs offensive linemen. If you're a quarterback who's like worth anything, you go top 10 because that's just what we do in the NFL now. We take players in the, like if you're a quarterback who's not bad, they take you top 10, play you immediately, and if you suck, they cut you and they draft somebody the next year. Like, it's unbelievable how short the timeline is. So I do think positionally from that value, that works against Iamonu, but I think you nailed it, JC, with the Travis Hunter tidbit. I remember that game when he absolutely went off. And he's also playing at Stanford, which I think helps. He's a smart kid. He's got a good head on his shoulders, and he's used to playing a high-level competition, right? He's not playing at Southeast West Baltimore State at Hawaii. Like, he's playing at Stanford. So I like that. Hodges' heritage moment. On this day in 2008, the Saskatchewan Roughriders traded reigning CFL MOP Kerry Joseph to the Toronto Argonauts in exchange for offensive lineman Glenn January, defensive lineman Ronald Flemons, a first-round pick in 2008, and a second-round pick in 2010. Joseph threw for 4,000 yards, 17 touchdowns, and 14 picks in his first season with the Argos, who finished 4-14 amid a head coaching change. January and Flemons didn't last more than a year at the Riders, though the first-round pick acquired from Toronto was used to select Keith Scholigan, who was a key part of Saskatchewan's defensive line for 6 years. JC, how do you remember this trade?
Well, I remember as one of the first CFL trades that I was aware of, because I was just starting to become mature as a fan. I was reading the sports page in the newspaper every morning before school or right when I got home and tracking all the teams and all the moves. And this was right in the era where Kerry Joseph had just been the MOP. They still had CFL players in commercials on TV. Kerry Joseph was, and I want to say a Rogers commercial or something. You could see him everywhere. They had the Gibson's Finest ads for awards voting, and Kerry Joseph was always the front headliner for that as the Riders quarterback. And so he was a big name, and I thought, wow, this is stunning. Of course, I didn't know that that was more of a one-off season for Kerry Joseph. Didn't truly understand who he was as a player yet. But I can remember being shocked by this and thinking that the Riders made a terrible mistake. I think at the end, they won this trade based on what they were able to get on the draft picks.
Maybe. I mean, the Argonauts certainly didn't win this trade. We'll put it that way. Joseph, by the way, played one more season with the Argonauts. In 2009, he threw 10 touchdowns, 16 picks, and then he didn't play in 2010. He did suit up for Edmonton in 2011 and then eventually went back to Saskatchewan in 2014 as a 41-year-old, I think it was, 40 or 41. But obviously the Argonauts did not get what they were looking for out of this trade. If I remember correctly, their big solution to Kerry Joseph being cut following the 2009 season, by the way, was bringing in Cleo Lemon in 2010. So, like, not a strong run of success for the Argonauts. Though, funnily enough, just a couple years later in 2012, they fixed their quarterback room and won a Grey Cup because they, again, made a big trade, which was bringing in Ricky Ray from Edmonton. And I believe that trade was made by the same person as made the Kerry Joseph trade, because the person who was the GM in Saskatchewan in 2008 was then the GM in Edmonton in 2012. So interesting that somebody could trade away two MLP quarterbacks in the span of 4 years. One didn't really burn them. The other very, very much did. It's now time for the three-minute drill. Canadian defensive back Sidney Brown attended a Toronto Maple Leafs game on Monday where he was honored on the video board. How cool is that?
It's great to see a Super Bowl champion honored like that. But what I want to know is there going to be beef between the Brown twins? Because Chase Brown visited the Montreal Canadiens earlier this year, saw their training facility, got a jersey and the whole nine yards, did some videos with the team. Are we going to have an old school hockey scrap between the two twins wearing their respective jerseys? I don't know. I'd pay to see it. Mustafa Johnson signed a contract extension with the Montreal Alouettes through 2026. How important is he to their defense?
Extremely, right? The Alouettes were not the same team in the second half of the 2024 season, and I think a big part of that was Mustafa Johnson not being in the middle, right? He got hurt near the midway point of the season. I'm looking at it right now. No, actually, later than I thought. He was out the last three regular season games. And this team, yeah. No, yeah. They went 1-2 without him. And the defense, I thought, faltered in the postseason. So I was a little bit off on the regular season part. He played more than I thought. But the point is, yes, they very badly missed him. Come the postseason, for my money, Mustafa Johnson might be the most disruptive defensive player in the CFL, period. I think you can argue that. Mm-hmm. Montreal Alouettes U9 team won the Youth Flag Football World Championships in Disney World, coached by veteran defensive back, I believe it was Wesley Sutton. Is that right?
Najee Murray.
I always mix those two up. My apologies. Is that a big deal, JC, winning the Youth Flag Football World Championships?
Yeah, it's an awesome deal. This isn't the first time that a team from Montreal has had success at this stage. I know they've produced a number of great youth flag teams, but kudos to the Montreal Alouettes for making an official partnership, having this flag football academy going forward. I think it's a fantastic way to get the CFL brand out there to kids, to youth, having success in an international market as well. And I think more CFL teams need to follow suit. Richie Sindani's agent confirmed to 3 Down Nation that his client is taking the 2025 year off, prompting the Argonauts to move him to the retirement list. Will Toronto miss him?
I think they will to some extent. I mean, I don't think Richie Sindani was ever going to be an all-star in the CFL. But that being said, if this team is looking to start 3 Canadians at some point this year, Sindani, I think, would have been a useful player for that. They can get by if they're only starting 2. But if they try to start 3, that could be an issue. Canadian quarterback Curtis Work, who is currently rehabbing a torn ACL ahead of the NFL draft, believes it's realistic that he could be healthy for the start of training camp. Do you believe him?
I have learned long ago to never doubt O'Rourke when he says he will be recovering from an injury at record time. This guy is tough as nails. He played through that torn ACL the entire year, and he never looked out of sorts. I have no doubt in my mind that he'll be back for NFL training camp if he believes it. Canadian offensive tackle Alaric Jackson has signed a 3-year extension with the Los Angeles Rams worth a reported $57 million. Is that a good signing, Hodge?
That's a lot of money. That's more than he was projected to get by just about every publication I saw. But good for Jackson. I remember it was 2021. He was coming out of Iowa. I was watching him, and I was in communication with a number of CFL scouts who were watching him. And this was as he was falling down draft boards. Like, he was originally thought to be a mid-round NFL draft pick. Ended up going undrafted. I remember thinking it. I remember talking to people who were saying, how are, like, no, he's not a freak athlete, but like, he's a, I think he was a 4-year starter with the Hawkeye. It was like, how is this not a thing? Like, how are people not interested in taking this kid even as a flyer in round 7? Lo and behold, it took a year or two, but he has in fact become a starting NFL left tackle and a good one at that. Good for him for getting the bag. I don't know why he had to wait that long for it. 3 Down Nation contributor Santino Filoso has reported that the Ottawa Redblacks will be holding their training camp at Queen's University in Kingston. Is that a smart move?
I think it is. I've come around on CFL teams taking their training camp further afield every year. I think it's a good way to connect with new communities of fans, spread the love, potentially attract some people to make a road trip out to your home games, and make sure that fans from markets that don't necessarily get to see the CFL all the time in person can connect with this product. I love the fact that the Redblacks will be at that beautiful Richardson Stadium for training camp. AJ Ouellette took to Instagram to reveal a newly shredded 200-pound physique, down 25 pounds from his usual playing weight. Do you think that'll help him coming the start of the season?
I do. And by the way, I can confirm that he's down 25 pounds because as he lost them, I think I found them. So he has lost the weight. He looks great. And I will say this. I saw some feedback, people saying, well, that doesn't make any sense for him. How's he going to run over people? Well, sorry. AJ Ouellette didn't run over anybody in 2024. Mm-hmm. He needs to run around them, and I don't think he's going to miss this weight. He's, I think, going to be a better player than he was this past year because he was not very useful for the Riders, frankly, in 2024. I like the idea of shaking things up for 2025 because I don't think the status quo was going to make much sense. Dakota Prukop has been named the quarterback's coach of the Calgary Stampeders after Bo Baldwin resigned due to personal health issues. Will Prukop be a good addition to that staff?
I think he could be. I think sometimes people will look at this hire and go, well, he wasn't that great as a player. Great short yardage guy, but not necessarily a great quarterback. I don't think that holds you back as a coach. He's been around this league for a long time. He's seen the inside of a lot of locker rooms. He's learned a lot of different systems. I think that he will be very good in this role. Team Saskatchewan is wearing Rough Rider gloves while competing in this year's Brier. How'd that come about?
Well, I spoke to Kevin Marsh, the team's second. His twin brother Dan plays lead. All these twins, JC, we're talking about the Phil Potts. We're talking about the Browns. We're talking about the Ford brothers. I don't know what it is with the twins in athletics, but the Marsh twins were on a tour of Mosaic Stadium when the Brier was in Regina in 2024 when they casually commented, hey, these gloves would be great for curling. And since then, Gordy, the equipment manager of the Rough Riders, has been hooking them up with gloves. So they wanted a big shout out to Gordy, and I will honor that. Shout out Gordy for hooking Team Saskatchewan up. Mike McEwen, 6-0 to start the Brier this year. BMO Field in Toronto, pardon me, BMO, I always say BMO and then I get roasted. BMO Field in Toronto is getting $150 million in upgrades ahead of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Do you think that could help boost attendance for the Argonauts?
I'm ambivalent towards this at this stage. I don't necessarily think it will have a positive or negative effect on the Argonauts, but having a better stadium is never a bad thing. Perhaps the Calgary Stampeders should take note.
Hey, they could do $150 million of upgrades to McMahon, and then it would be worth about $120 million. That would be great. On that note, we thank you as always for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. Don't forget to rate and subscribe. Give us 5 stars, the full thing. That is always helpful. We'll see you next week for our next episode.
At Tanger Outlets, find all the best brands all on sale every day. Step into the season's newest arrivals and save big on the styles you love. Shop Under Armour, Michael Kors, Crocs, and more. With up to 70% off, plus an extra 25% off for a limited time. Hurry in for amazing deals from the brands you love. Only at Tanger Outlets.